Podcasting is a complicated profession, which is why we're here to discuss Andor, currently airing on Disney Plus. My name is Dan Morin, and I am joined, as always, by my co-host, Kat Benish is here.
Hello! Hi, this is the saddest version of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid I've ever seen.
Do you remember how that movie ends?
Yeah.
Tony Sindelar is also here. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Dan. Hi, Kat. I just have one question for you. What did you sacrifice? Sorry. Excuse me. What did you sacrifice?
Everything. We are here to discuss season 1, episode 10 of Andor, entitled One Way Out, which is one better than No Way Out, in case you're keeping track at home. We should do a quick...
Definitely not up to fire code, just saying.
Quick overview. Well, there's railings, though, which is a big step up from most other Imperial facilities.
This is true. Floor, though.
So this episode, we're going to go through the main plots and talk about everything that transpired this week. And I think we're going to start... with Cassian?
Let's start with Cassian.
Mm-hmm. A few things happened in Cassian's world this week. After a lot of people... I feel like there are a lot of complaints, again, about the pacing of these episodes, which I don't agree with, which is
like...
What
are the complaints?
People think it's too slow. They're like, oh, you know, it's the classic, when do we get to the fireworks factory, joke about when's stuff going to happen. It's like, ah, but you got to build, right? You got to pace it out. And this week, it delivers, right? This whole prison break sequence, I don't know about you, it's spelled Tony, I know about Kat because she was sitting next to me when we watched this, but I felt like I was on the edge of my seat, literally on the edge of the seat the whole time. So we see the whole plan in action, and so some of the plan is less well put together than others because, you know, Cassian essentially decides we've got to do this now because they're going to bring us someone to replace Ulov.
And they start, Ulov getting put into the body bag.
Yeah, exactly. And sort of like Kino has already sort of committed, but Cassian is trying to like drive it home and really seal the deal, be like, yeah, we got to do this. We got to do this.
Oh, they have that great scene sort of, I think, when they're arguing over... I can't remember. So basically, Kino is essentially freaking out of like what's going on, and they like switch places, and they keep saying on program, as they line up to walk out of the room. And it first shows Kino sort of trying to be under control and saying on program to Cassian, and Cassian doesn't come along. Is like, no, this is the moment, this is the moment. And then you see Kino like, I have to say, Andy Serkis's work through is like running his hands through his hair, increasingly getting frenetic. And then eventually it's Cassian who's in control saying, get on program. He's the one forcing. And I think that's the moment where I think in my mind, where Kino, the dynamic shifts and Kino becomes, I think, 100% on. And then, they go to essentially the cells and everyone's chattering. What's going on? What's going on? What's going on? And that's when we also see Kino step up to be the leader, right? And says, we have one night to figure this out, which is great.
And even... I love that scene where because they're in that long hallway and they're like, people are like, what's going on? And there's someone in the distance who's like louder because I can't hear what you people are saying. And I don't know. I love Andy Serkis's performance in this episode. I think I've always been kind of neutral on him as an actor. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if he's ever impressed me until this episode. And then I'm like, wow, he does a lot in this. And his character is complicated, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think he already goes from this kind of complicated role as, you know, he is the complicit shift leader, right? Where he is an extension of the Imperial power and, keeping law and order. But he is a prisoner and he seems to have no privileges based on his position there, and it puts him kind of alone. And he has done a lot of he is not turning people in, but he does a lot of like stop doing stuff that makes us look bad or makes us look suspicious. And in this, he becomes a leader of the prison riot. And of course, we haven't gotten to it, but his fate ? Just further complicates that in terms of like what is going through his brain in all this episode. But, you know, we see in that hallway with him and Cassian when they're walking back and forth from standing at the door and not standing at the door, like he is like, you know, they are having an argument, and it's like Kino is also having an argument with himself in his head.
100%.
And it's pretty amazing.
Is like that he's lawful, right? Like, and if you want to put this in D&D like terms, right?
Yeah,
like,
which we do.
He's about rules, right? Yeah. Like he is like, I want to follow the rules. If I behave correctly, everyone will get out. And like this promise has been made to us. And one of the things that I think is great about the way this whole prison arc has been done is that not once do we hear anything basically about what any of them have done to end up in prison, yeah. Right? There's very briefly at the beginning a mention that, like, you know, they ask Cassian and he's like, I didn't do anything. And they're like, yeah, there's a lot of that, you know? So, it's totally irrelevant, but it also doesn't dehumanize them to us as the viewers, right? Because it doesn't reduce them to something like, well, they're criminals, right? Like, we don't know. Some of them might be criminals. Some of them might be people who just, like Cassian, ran afoul, were in the wrong place at the wrong time, you know? But it doesn't matter. We see them as humans, as people who are, like, being imprisoned against their will, which I think is very much how the story wants to portray that.
And I think with that, too, and I think building on that lawful good is, like, and again, just...
not necessarily good. Lawful.
Lawful. But I think that's fair. But also, like, at least I think Kino's trying to be lawful good in this, like, following the rules for the good of the order, and, like, it's trying to be a good guy. Mm-hmm. But, I actually have always loved Andy Serkis, and I'm really happy to see him behind the motion capture, because I think he's never gotten a lot of credit for, like, a lot of his work, because it's always like, oh, it's essentially CGI, and people see Gollum, but they don't see Andy Serkis. Or they see King Kong, they don't see Andy Serkis. But when he comes back, and they're all chattering, and he walks into his cell, I don't know if you guys caught it, as he walks in, he briefly glances to his number. Like, it's this wonderful, very quick moment, and then he keeps going. And again, just that brilliant acting to show, like, why? What is he thinking about, realizing the number doesn't matter? It's all a lie. And then goes to the back of a cell to work it out. I thought it was, again, it was really... I think what I've talked about all the way through. I love this show just because of its really... those lovely shots of just showing, like, how all the characters are unfolding.
I think the message that I assume that Tony Gilroy wants us to take away from this is that regardless of what these people did to be here, presumably many of them are here unjustly. And even those who may be, you know, we aren't really shown kind of a hardened criminal archetype, right? Like, they just seem like these are just people who are, you know, have gotten swept up in this, right? We don't see, for example, violence among the other prisoners. But regardless of perhaps what they did to end up here, I think there's the message, the unspoken message that no one here deserves to be life in prison, forced labor for the rest of their life with brutal electric floors, torture, right? And especially we do have the implication that it's like, at one point, maybe there was a chance you were getting out, but under the new system, and I think there's a slightly more lines here we talked about last time, like, what was the mistake that was made? And it seems like probably you're supposed to get shuffled from one prison to another when your sentence is up, and somebody got shuffled within the prison instead of one sentence to another, thus revealing that, like, you never get out. Again, I don't know if it's really important, but the idea is that, you know, the punishment these people are facing is inhumane and inappropriate for whatever got them here, regardless of what that is.
I think it's also interesting from a shooting standpoint. It only occurred to me right now. I mean, in several of the interviews I've been reading with Tony Gilroy in the last week, the people ask him about, like, lack of aliens and stuff. And it is this entire, you know, prison is pretty much human. It's also all men, which doesn't, you know, not shocking from a prison standpoint, but also
you can imagine there's another one. Women.
Absolutely. That's the thing. And that's the thing that struck me, whereas, like, you know, in a lot of cases I could see a story taking flack for that by not, but, like, because it's so, it's not the point of the story, and so much of this, you know, it is such a diverse group of people, you know, who are imprisoned among the men that, like, it doesn't end up being, it doesn't feel as material, like, to me, to not, it's like, oh, you know, it's not representation, but it's like, the women are in another prison, but they're having the exact same problems here.
And yet, though, I will still point out, my number one critique of Rogue One is there are no women on the party that's actually invading the planet, right? Yeah. There are no women in Rogue One except for Jyn Erso, and, like, I think one pilot
like two
with one
others,
line.
But
it makes no, that makes no sense.
Yes, no, I agree.
This, I'm like, okay, that makes sense.
But it works, it's because the story, I think, makes, it computes for this.
It's,
but,
you know, and Dan sent me and Kat a zillion various Tony Gilroy. They'll be in the show notes. Dan shared with us a bunch of, I think he's doing a major press push here. It sounds like there's even a thing where it's like, you know, the Lord of the Rings show and Game of Thrones are wrapped up. Please let this be the next water cooler prestige TV while there's still a couple episodes left of it. You know, lots of people are asking him about the no aliens thing. And he has the point about, like, well, I want this to be a human story. And so it's humans. And, you know, I guess I don't know if I love that answer. I'm fine with it. I guess I wish it wasn't distracting to me, and maybe it's just distracting because so much of Star Wars is aliens, and why couldn't there be, you know, a couple aliens here in this this jail, that even if they're slightly more humanoid looking aliens or whatnot, but I don't know. It's It is not the, it is a choice he has made. It's fine. I think it just distracts from perhaps a minor expectation, but also, I don't know, this show is so good that maybe my brain is just casting away around for things that it's like little quibbles with a show that I otherwise find so masterfully executed.
Yeah, I don't, it does not bother me. It does not bother me because I can also in my mind tell a story of it's the Empire, right? And they think of aliens as lesser to humans, right? Do they just kill the aliens rather than putting them in jail, right? There's a lot of even darker stories we can tell that are like, as bad as the humans are, the aliens are second-class citizens in this empire, that there is a reason of why that is.
And maybe we'll see stuff in season two. It is weird to me where, you know, this is a show, a Star Wars show that is a lot about power and colonialism, and it's like, they pretty much established in previous stuff that it's like, the Imperials are almost all humans,
right?
And there's a lot of planets full of aliens that are just like being destroyed for their natural resources.
Right, I mean, we have that with the labor. The interrogation scene, remember, with the whole like the race that's killed and then they use the for the torture, right? Like that's kind of endemic of it, but we don't even really see it. I think you guys can tune into my prestige series about the Bothan spies. It's like 12 episodes on the Bothan spies who died to get all the information about the second Death Star.
All I can remember, though, if you guys ever read my favorite book series in the Star Wars one is, of course, the Rogue Squadron series. And they do make a point of essentially the Bothans, like, that's all they then talk about for, like, the rest of the New Republic to the point where I'm like, oh. So, and like, now it's inculcated in me. It's like, oh, not the Bothan spies again. Like, you guys did your bit. Let's be honest. I do have to call out, too, and I'm sure those of you who are on Twitter watching the very quick demise and implosion of Twitter, one of the best tweets I saw, I think you guys may have seen as well, is everyone else writing a Disney Plus Star Wars show. The thesis of my show is I played with action figures as a kid, and now I get to make my favorite characters do cool things. That's like all the other shows. Tony Gilroy, the one way out of fascist rule is armed revolution. It's like, that's Ed Kev Kozer. It's like, yep, that's
that one's
funny.
Up there with the one about the, like, this is a very serious show where at any minute the characters could meet Jar Jar Binks. So I really enjoy the prison break moment because it has this great balance between something that is being planned and yet also realizing they have to react on the fly. Like they got to go now because this is their opportunity. They're going to get somebody to replace Ulov and it doesn't work unless they bring a new person down onto the floor.
And they realize that they know the word has got out about level two, right? Which is why they can't do the sharing those one words between those. Everyone has to be now on program basically or quiet when they go through.
They're cracking down.
And they realize they don't have enough guards. So they're going to add more guards too. So yeah, this is the one chance.
Timing, right? And that makes everything feel very tense because of that. And so when the plan goes off, it is not the well-oiled machine. Like it's not a bad plan, but it's not a well-oiled machine. Lots of people die. Cassian's in there like scraping away at that water pipe, which I thought was a great bit. It lends to the tension of this moment when it's like, we're not going to be able to sit around and think about this forever and concoct the perfect plan. We got to take our opportunity and go.
It also feels like there is, the plan only goes so far because they have limited knowledge.
Right.
The plan is basically gets them up into the control room above their work area. And then they're kind of improvising, right?
Yeah.
And I think they also, it's unclear to me how many people on the shift are like with them. Though, you know, they get ready and they're throwing their machinery parts at the two guards with guns and people are dying and like, Cassian's right. I was kind of like wondering, like, you know, from the Cassian Andor character, like, is he going to be hanging back, saving his own skin? But he's pretty much right up there in the fray. Like, you know, people that get shot right next to him that could have just as easily been him. And, you know, they get up to the main control room of the prison and they put Kino on the intercom. And it's like, is that the plan? They don't know how the other shifts are going to react, right?
Right.
This is not a heist where every piece of the plan is clockwork.
Mm-hmm.
There is some, it seems like there's some improvisation and they're running down the hallway and there's the giant drop into the water.
Yeah.
And it's like, is this the plan? It doesn't seem like it's the plan. And it is the difference, I guess, between perhaps somebody's individual Shawshank Redemption scape versus this is a prison break. This is we're taking everybody out.
But they're already dead, right? And I think that's what underlines it is like they all know they're already dead, so it doesn't really matter. Like, because if even four of them get out alive, we know two of them get out alive. Like that's success. And I think I think the what's also taking a step back and looking at this, we've talked a lot about like, okay, this show is supposed to be about Cassian's arc. And I think of how does he end up on the beach in Rogue One, mm-hmm. willing to make the ultimate sacrifice. And I think this is the first time we see Cassian, like we saw him becoming a bit of a leader and a mentor and more empathetic because he's helping with Olaf. Here he's getting Kino. And I think really interestingly, and I can't remember if it's one of the articles you forwarded, Dan, or just generally about it, what speaks to me about him being even like evolving as a leader is he knows he can't be the one that makes the speech, right? Mm-hmm. He doesn't have the reputation. He doesn't have the credentials. But the fact he can get essentially the plant foreman or the shift leader to the one to give the speech of like, if Kino's willing to speak about this, then it isn't, he's one to get others. And the fact they also, he's not trying to get Hilny, his group out. We talked about, we even wondered, is he going to get the entire prison out? And yeah, they did. That's the call they made. It's like, we're going to get everyone out.
It actually dovetails really nicely with the point that I think we'll talk about in a little bit with Luthen's speech. In some ways, Cassian is very much positioned to be sort of, you know, Luthen's apprentice or something like that, in the sense of like, it's the sort of, again, the real politic view on in order to accomplish this goal, here is all the things that have to happen. And I know the parts I can play and the parts I can't play. And sometimes I'm going to have to be callous and sometimes people are going to die. But I just kind of got to keep pushing out. And, you know, to your point about the sort of frenetic nature of the escape, I mean, that's kind of, I think, where the one way out chant comes in. Like you said, they're already dead, you know, it's a question of how do you want to go down, or like that old classic line about the, when the fall is all that's left, it matters a great deal. You know, it's, there's only, you know, how do you want to live your life? How do you want to go out? And the answer is for a lot of them, and as Cassian points out, like, I'd rather fight and try to get out than to just sit here and quietly die.
And the dynamic between Kino and Cassian as they are executing the plan, where, and because Kino uses Cassian's words in that speech, right? He is quoting Cassian. So it's like, is Cassian a leader there? Is Kino the leader there? It's kind of a partnership, which is perhaps what you need if you're going to join, say, a alliance of rebels.
Interesting.
Right? Because it's because Cassian can't be the mouthpiece or the spokesperson for this, but he does have the words and ideas that are going to mean more coming out of somebody else's mouth. But also, he's kind of inspired by Kino. And even, Kino's speech to the prisoners. This episode is very theatrical, I think, at times, in between the giant action set pieces. And the writer of this episode has been a playwright, and I feel like that shows through. I think I saw some people criticizing this, and I was like,
really?
That aspect of this episode and the other episodes written by, I think it's Bo Williamson.
Willeman,
and I was like, Willeman, and I was like, I like it.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, people are like, Luthen's soliloquy at the end, people don't talk like that. And it's like, okay, but it's still great. But Kino's speech, and especially, I just love the part where he's like, help the person who's lost or fallen, bring them with you, right? And look out for your brothers kind of thing. I don't know. There is a heart to that as opposed to just like run, you know, or like this is your
for
time.
Yourself, but like we,
you know,
it is going to ultimately be, to a certain degree, we all see a little bit of your enemy when they get to the very top, and let's talk about like Kino X, but there is a degree, Vic, where you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. It isn't just everyone one way out, everyone for themselves, but help each other as much as you can, because it will maximize.
It takes all of us. It takes a village.
You know, there is violence in this. We have a bunch of Imperials that are shot. This is another episode that reminds us that the stun setting does not exist in this episode. Maybe I don't know.
Can't
no, they have stun settings in the cartoons and stuff. I was like,
yeah,
maybe stun setting doesn't get invented until A New Hope.
We'll talk about, hopefully we can do an episode on Tales of the Jedi, right? That one of those episodes is nothing but the stun setting.
Correct.
Just like,
they cut costs on the rifles when they hand the blasters, when they give them to the Imperial guards. They're like, a stun, it's expensive. It's expensive to add a whole stun setting.
Also, the stun setting can't be deflected by lightsabers. Again, we're talking about Tales of the Jedi. But like, tactically, it makes no sense not to use it. Anyways.
But
That was Order 67, was don't use the stun setting.
But, you know, they leave the two Imperials in the command room in the corner on program. They show a room of Imperials kind of hiding, cowering as the prisoners rush by. So their goal here is get out. Their goal is not slaughter all of our jailers. Right.
Yeah, which is, I was actually surprised that Andor didn't kill the two in the control center. That was actually different than what I expected.
I just didn't see a reason for him to, like, they're not armed either.
But they can send out an emergency message.
Sure, absolutely. But they'll be gone by then, I think is the point. Like, we're not trying to hold this prison. We are not trying to stay here. We are just trying to leave.
But if you want to buy as much time as possible.
I think he just decides it's not, like, you know, I'm not saying he's not willing to kill, but there is certainly a difference in that scenario versus the scenario he finds himself in at the beginning of the series.
Yeah, I guess
he kills when it's expedient to a certain degree or when he's backed into a corner, I think.
Or the individual versus the system.
But I don't think in this case, you know, he realizes they have the power here now. And at that point, there's no point to it. I mean, I love the reveal also of the, you know, we've had that nameless voice in the deep voice the whole time. And, you know, to me, that was like a great reveal that when you have the pan around, it's like, it's just some dude,
just some middle manager,
right? You know? So I think there's a nice bit there where it shows us the sort of, not the humanity exactly, but it's like, yeah, what seemed like this oppressive voice of God is actually just some weaselly dude who's getting paid minimum wage probably to run this prison.
Can we talk about Kino in the end there?
Yeah.
Because I want to say, people may criticize the pacing, but the pacing, I think, allows us to really form attachments to characters.
Mm-hmm.
I was emotionally devastated when Kino shared he couldn't swim. In my mind, I had this whole canon where he was going to go off and join. He was going to join the rebellion and be one of the early leaders. And to see that Kino, like that bittersweet, like happiness that he'd made it this far, and then the inability to go any further.
The delivery of that line, and we did watch an interview with Andy Serkis where they talked about, like, he tried the line a bunch of different ways.
Like angry.
Or whatever. But, like, I think it is such a great delivery with the just sort of bemused, like, sad, but also, like you said, like, happy. You know, it's the leader who never sees the promised land sort of moment. You know, you get a glimpse of it, and that's it. I think it was Moses. Moses dies within sight of the promised land, but never gets to enter it. And, you know, I think having that moment where he is, like, he has made this happen, and he has enabled so many of these people. And that was his role, right? Like, he took him upon himself, even when he was collaborating with the prisoners. Like, he was looking out for his people.
Yeah.
And I think he still ultimately is doing that here. And it's tragic. And I'm curious to know, like, I have my opinion on this. Do you think you ever see Kino again?
I don't know.
I mean, Star Wars rules, we don't see him die. so you never know. I mean, you know, all throughout this episode, I was like, oh, maybe Kino's going to be a key part of the rebellion. And, you know, we're going to see a lot of Kino in season two. And he and Cassian are going to be like
buddies
and co-workers for so long. And just, yeah, his delivery of that line. I don't, Dan, it's like, there's so many emotions in that line, at least as I hear it. You know, I feel like, because there's like, I feel like there's in a sense of like, amusement in his voice, even you know, like,
Rye,
by the way, I never mentioned that I can't swim, but also like I've done what I needed to do, you're all getting out, and like I kind of am happy at that, even though also I know that maybe I am dead. And it's like, and we don't know, and there's even the thing where it's like, you know, maybe Andor wants to save him, but he's pushed over the edge by the horde of, and so he has no opportunity to even kind of react to that, because you could imagine it's like, well, you know, there's a zillion prisoners here. Maybe they could, indeterminate far amount of way away, and they all seem to split up because it's just Cassian and what is his name? Begins with an M.
Melchi
make it to another beach, not a Scarif beach, but another beach. And, you know, could Kino have been dragged to safety? Does Kino stay behind? Does he get arrested? You know, we don't know. But it was just, I don't know, just the way that line was delivered was very interesting. But also, everybody should learn to swim.
And then for those who haven't seen the Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, there is, I'm spoiling a little bit, but one of the best lines is just as they're about to jump in the water to, I think, escape, either Butch realizes.
Yeah, I think he says
that he can't swim as they're jumping down into the water.
Oh, no, it's Sundance. It's Sundance, because then Butch says, the fall will kill you, right? Which is a great line.
Yeah.
Like, why are you worrying about this when this is the only way to get out of this, right?
Yeah.
You know, I think that is a great moment. I think maybe a top moment of this entire show so far. And I mean, my opinion is I don't think we ever see him again. It's not impossible,
either.
But like, I kind of feel like the bittersweet ending is the point. That is the reason that we saw him get to that point. And it's unfinished, but you know what? That's life, right? Like sometimes you meet somebody and they change, you know, they have a big impact on your life and you never see them again. That's just how it goes. And I think what's they've shown, Tony Gilroy's shown resistant to doing here is falling into some of those like tropes of the, like, we're going to narratively wrap this up in a way, like a nice, like convenient storytelling fashion. We're going to sort of adhere to like, you know, a very fictionalized rule of how these things work. Oh, you introduce a character only to have them come back and save the day or whatever. Right. But like, I think he's bucking that and trying to say like, yeah, life is brutal sometimes and tragic, and that's just how it goes.
We even saw Oh, go ahead, Tony.
There is the kind of contrast between, you know, you have the prisoners in white pouring out of the prison into the water, and there's just the horde of them swimming away, and it's daytime and it's sunny on the water is very blue, and then we cut to that, you know, hours, days, weeks later, the dark beach, presumably on the same planet, and it's just Cassian and Melshi.
Yeah.
Because I did wonder, it's like, where do all these people go? And it seems like Cassian is kind of on his own again, right? You know?
I feel
him and Melshi.
I think more people, I like to envision that more people escaped. They all like just sort of went their own way and like maybe struck out for different pieces of land. But I was surprised, going back to what Dan was saying too, like the redhead, I forget his name, who is also at the table with him, like they kill him like really early on the heist, or the escape, and there's no time to mourn, they just keep going and moving on.
Same with the other guy who's like, he's the two of them, he and Cassian are set up on either side of the lift.
Yeah.
And they've been talking about the plan or whatever. That guy gets shot like one, you know, 30 seconds in, that guy's dead, you know? And like, I think again, it's certainly willing to dispose of characters that we only meet for a brief time. A lot of the prisoners that we kind of have gotten to know, you know, the people on the table, it's like, it's a rush, right? Like, it's like, it makes me think of being in line, you know, we've gone to some like, you know, conventions and stuff, and you're in line and you strike up conversations with people that you meet in line. And then there's like, oh, we're letting everybody in. And there's a rush. And it's like, yep, never see those people ever again. There we go.
Yeah, prison is like conferences. I agree.
It's exactly the same, basically.
That is Dan's closest frame of reference.
Indeed it is. Should we talk about, what, Mon Mothma?
Sure. Yeah, obviously these plot segments, I think, are shorter, and either they're one or a few scenes. We've got Mon Mothma and her banker friend, and we meet Davos Khaldun, shady businessman who has shown up here, and it like makes it real clear to Mon Mothma that like, I think we get a little bit more filling in around the edge that like she's trying to do stuff with her family fortune, and there's basically there's regulations put in place by the Empire that limit what she can do legitimately, and like, you know, Davos is really kind of like reminding her again and again that what you're doing is you know, technically illegal, which sure is surprising for someone who's you know, so pure and perfect. But the price for he is not interested in money. You know, everyone has money, says the super rich people to each other. What he wants is legitimacy, is my reading of it, in the form of introducing his son to Mon Mothma's daughter, because we know that on Chandrila they do arranged marriages. He has not suggested an arranged marriage, but
pretty kind
of the
close.
First steps. Yeah, at least step one of that. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's an interesting, I think you're totally right. He wants legitimacy. He wants to be Bethany. He talks about being invited to the embassy.
Yeah.
Right. And like, oh, I only got to come here once and it's so nice and everything. That's how nice to be invited into the seat of power where I, you know, can hobnob with the other officials. It is the new money, old money divide. Right. And I don't know what you're reading. Like Mon Mothma, I kind of love this scene, brief as it is, because she has this moment of being like, no, I'm absolutely not going to do that. I had a bad experience, right? Like, we've seen her relationship with Perrin, not a healthy marriage. But he has that one bit. He's very unflummoxed by this entire conversation.
The one lie you've said
The
today.
One lie you told me is that you weren't considering it.
Yeah.
And I think I'm kind of curious to know how you feel like, is he going to take them up on that? Like, is she going to bite on that?
I mean, I think in my reading of what this show is about, my interpretation of Cassian Andor is of the TV show Andor, not the character Andor, is that Andor is basically all about what will people sacrifice, toward the for the rebellion, and that means that Mon Mothma's going to sacrifice something. And you know, is it her daughter, her family, her position as a senator, all of the above? But I mean, something. I mean, she's already down the path of she's done stuff with money that she's got to cover her tracks.
Yeah.
And I think the way this show goes is that she is gonna pay a price for that. And I think the thesis of the show is more that she will do something as opposed to just like her choices will catch up with her. So if not this, then something else, and probably this.
Yeah, and again, I love the shots they show with Mon Mothma as they walk out of the room. Once again, the show loves framing Mon Mothma by herself in the center, dead center, surrounded by the pomp of her embassy, just showing her trapped in her position. And this one, I think they had it last week, was Val walked out. They had her sort of framed by the elevator or whatever it is, and this time it's framed with the windows behind her. It's just, again, just showing her. And I think going back to what we were talking about, is Mon Mothma, I think, wanted to be involved and really believes in this, but I think thought that she could do it by staying above the fray. And I think last episode she realized that she had the whole thing about strange bedfellows, and now there's the cost of that. And is she willing to pay that cost? I don't know. I wonder what she will do.
I think she's going to do it. I think she's going to bite on it, because it's like, I mean, it's too easy to say that like her relationship with her daughter is already strained and there's nothing to be lost from that. But at the same time, it feels very much like putting that on the screen. It's a Chekhov's gun sort of thing, right? Yeah. Like, she needs to make this move happen. And in order for that to happen, if this is the only way to do it, she's going to do it. And she's going to feel terrible about it. And we're going to explore what that means when she feels guilt about, like, essentially sacrificing, you know, her kid for the rebellion. Mm-hmm. But Vel said last week the rebellion comes first. She can play it off to herself and convince herself that it's just being done. But you know, I think it's gonna happen, and I think that's gonna be some interesting tension.
I wonder how Perrin will feel about it too. Like, I kind of get the feeling that he might be willing to support it, because like it represents, I don't know if he's stuck on knowing people of the right class, but knowing people with money and power seems more Perrin's speed.
Maybe.
Yeah, money buys parties, and that seems to be
Perrin's motivation.
Yeah, I wonder if you know, maybe something will crank up the heat on Mon Mothma to make that decision sooner rather than later. You know, you could imagine things kind of closing in as we have two episodes left.
Yeah.
Should we turn our attention to same planet, but several levels down?
Well, let's talk about ISB briefly about ISB first.
This was a really interesting one. So it's a really short scene, and Miro comes in. Oh no! What was really interesting about this is the first time I think we see what Anton Lesser's character's name again?
Partagaz.
He's the one who enters the room to everyone else already being there, versus everyone else. I think show again shows that we talk about like the increasing power and reputation of Miro. In this case, now
he's coming to her.
Right? Which I think is a really, really powerful sign. They're saying, "Hey, we're successful with Krieger. We've put him back in the shipping lane." And then we see the character whose now name we know is Lonnie.
Lonnie and Clea hang out.
Lonnie and Clea, down at the dunks. Who makes this line of like, "Hey, we need to continue to follow protocol. We would investigate this as Krieger would be expecting us to." So Krieger's still in the storyline, and I think Krieger was probably maybe going to be coming to a head in the next two episodes. But then,
I still think it's all off screen. That's
my feeling.
Potentially
all off screen. I believe that. But what's super interesting in this moment, and I don't know, Tony, what you thought of this, because Dan and I couldn't figure it out. When Lonnie makes that statement,
Miro has a weird
look. That's kind of like an oh shit moment. Looks at her subordinate. They have like some eyes crossing the room, and then they run out of the room. And it's unclear whether she's like, Lonnie has betrayed himself somehow, or they've realized they forgot something critical about Krieger, or they're going off to do Anton Lesser's bidding. But it seemed like there was something there that we're just not sure what that is, if that shoe will ever drop. What did you think?
I read it as, oh yes, we should continue to basically make sure that the facade that we don't know about this, and that business as usual is happening in that sector. And we just got to get on that real quick to make sure everything looks right. So, you know, rather than steering clear of the dead pilot, we're going to investigate it, because that's what we should do. And so we got to go make that happen. But maybe I wasn't piecing that together with what we would see later because I didn't suspect Lonnie. And I think, have we talked about Lonnie, perhaps without naming Lonnie before, in terms of like, no. Is Lonnie getting for a promotion or whatnot? But, you know, it does seem like every interaction in ISB is fraught in terms of like, can you trust anyone who is, yeah. you know, who's going to get you killed versus who's going to steal your job? I just saw that as like, you know, they have this spy operation that they're going, and they want Krieger to do the attack on Spellhouse and be there waiting for him, and yeah. so they're trying to make sure nothing tips off, and so they have to like make things look as legitimate as possible. Which of course then when Lonnie goes to talk to Luthen,
I did not see this coming at all. We were wondering when Clea says they're going to meet with someone. I was actually thinking it was going to be Bail Organa. Like, we haven't spoken to him over years. Like, oh, we're finally going to pull Bail Organa into this mix. And then the fact it was Lonnie, did not see that coming.
Real Departed vibes here, where it's like, we've basically made this guy like climb the ranks at ISB so we can get to this point. And I love it because it's Luthen's point. Is 100% correct. This guy is so much more valuable, right?
Like, it's Coventry. Like, it's what you and I talked about. It's exactly. like Coventry when they allow the bomber to go ahead.
Yeah, in World War II, yeah. And then, like, it is this moment where we see Luthen ultimately for, you know, the kind of guy we knew he was, right? His conversation with Saw, his conversation with, you know, Cassian and Clea about Cassian, all of this stuff where it's like, you know, he is willing to sacrifice... he's willing to sort of like, he's playing chess, right? Like, he's willing to say like, I'm willing to let those pawns get taken because we've got a queen over here that needs to be protected. And it's Lonnie. I love this because Lonnie's just like, I want out. Like, this is too much. I am in deep and I have a kid now and I just don't, I can't do this anymore. And Luthen's like, nah, but can't you, don't you have to?
I think it's more than that, Dan. I think it's like, you don't have a choice. There is no out. Like, listen to your, I mean, he does the thing where he's like, listen to what you would tell the Imperials. You don't even believe it, right? Yeah. Like, there is no out. Even if you wanted to stop being a mole, you're stuck working for the Imperials who you are not actually, you don't buy into their values and their thing. And that's eating away at you. And that's what you want to get out. Definitely Departed vibes. But, you know, I think this did kind of underscore for Luthen. I mean, we put a price on it here. He's willing to let 50 men die preserve a source. And we have the horrible duality here of, like, you know, the ISB knows secrets and they're not changing how they do stuff to maintain stuff. And Luthen knows secrets, but he's not changing stuff. So it's like both sides are just kind of moving forward, pretending that they don't know anything that's up. And we know people will die. I was trying to figure out the math on, you know, Saw Gerrera in terms of, we know Saw Gerrera is pretty in bad shape by the time we see him in Rogue One. And it was like, could this be the incident that leads to that? I don't think that quite works out, but I keep thinking about that every time Saw Gerrera comes up. Is it's like,
you gotta lose a leg.
You gotta lose some legs.
And doesn't Lonnie also ask Luthen if he was an Aldani?
Yes, he does. He does sort of say, like, there was this big thing, and Luthen lies like he breathes, man.
Again,
he is
I think he says, like, we were invited, but we said no because basically they got there because they were lucky, and we don't bank on luck. So he's in the center of everything, but just doesn't want anyone to know. It's so good.
And we know Lonnie points out they're looking for Axis, right? Yeah. And he is... I think Lonnie suspects that is Luthen, but Luthen is not going to confirm that even remotely.
Because he can't let anyone else know, because then he would be firming this up. Because if they ever get to Lonnie, right, they can go after Luthen.
I keep waiting for
that. It also makes Lonnie, I think, would be... Sorry, I was going to say, I think Lonnie's also concerned because Lonnie would probably feel that he's at risk if they do find Axis, because then he knows backwards. So I think, like, it actually makes a lot of sense lying about this. But sorry, I cut you both off.
No, it's all good. I keep waiting for a line where Luthen's like, Axis, I think of myself a little bit more as a fulcrum.
I definitely, when they first threw that name out there, I was definitely like, oh, we're going a lot of physics references. But I think at the same time, it reminded me a lot of that scene of Luthen and Saw too, right? Where he has that moment of being like, I can't let anybody in on this. I can't tell anybody what we're doing. I deny everything. and that is the only way this is going to work. And this is a segue into our, you know, Luthen's monologue there at the end,
yeah,
which is, you know, sort of the what did you sacrifice? And it's fascinating because I wouldn't say we learn anything new about Luthen in the sense of like who he is or what his background is, but we now understand him. Yes. I mean, that's what it comes down to me. Like, he talks about all this stuff where I made my mind a sunless space and I basically have given up any hope that I will have a life or any happiness. Like, all I can do is sort of follow the steps that I laid out. He mentions 15 years ago, which is roughly the fall of the Republic. You know, I saw conspiracy theories online that it means Luthen's a Jedi. I don't believe that. I think that's... I mean, first of all, as I was saying to Kat earlier, that would be a ballsy move to be like, let me welcome you to my shop full of Jedi memorabilia. But I am definitely not a Jedi.
It doesn't feel consistent with the Star Wars story Tony Gilroy is telling us.
Not at all. Yeah, I 100%. Yeah. I feel like he is just this guy who realized he was, hey, we can, here are the steps it's going to take to basically start a real rebellion against the Empire. It's going to take us years to build this up, and it's going to have to be done like this, and there's going to be a lot of hard stuff that we have to do, and I'm the person who can do that. Like, that's just, I can see that path for me. It's just going to require me to sacrifice basically everything else in my life.
And everyone, too. Yeah. Right, I think, yeah. No, I thought it was...
Yep.
I went back and watched that part again, because I thought it was great, and everything about it was... I don't know. There's a nice. I should go back and watch again the speech he gives Cassian standing in the warehouse.
Oh yes.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah. Stellan Skarsgård, pretty good, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
He's quite good. Well, I was thinking about that too. It made me realize that I think it was when. So there's two parts to that conversation. That when he's telling Lonnie how important Lonnie is, I think Luthen is kind of full of it, right? And it made me realize that I think when he's pitching Cassian, that I don't know if he actually believes what he's saying, that like Cassian actually isn't that important. He just needed Cassian in that moment. He was prepared to tell Cassian he was the most important thing in the world. So like, I feel like that scene is finally explained to me. But when Luthen explains himself, I feel like his veracity changes, and I actually believe him fully. That's like how dedicated he is. And I think we get back to the question Saw asked, like, Luthen, what do you believe? I don't know where you stand. And I think we finally get a window into that of Luthen is just... as we just decided, Luthen is such a believer in the cause. I don't think he really cares how we get there. We just need to get there.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think Luthen is pretty dead inside.
You
know?
Yeah.
There is such an intensity to these words that feel like, you know, I mean, and you know, Lonnie is like, I mean, I think Lonnie sees like, oh, you have this, I don't know if Lonnie knows about his cover as a you know, an artifact dealer or whatever he is. But, you know, from Lonnie's perspective, it's like, you have it pretty cushy and I'm here, you know, twisting in the wind. And, you know, that I think that touched a nerve here with Luthen, who is kind of a dead man walking, or at least dead inside, in terms of, you know, he has nothing, he has no family, he has no friends, he has, you know, the people he is united with in purpose and cause, he actually keeps at a distance and can't share anything with them.
I also thought it was interesting that he we heard several times about the fact that we took an oath, which also implies that who do they give that oath to?
Right.
And did they all do it at the same time? Like, clearly they didn't line up like a secret society, like all 12 of them around, like, as I promise, solemn swear, et cetera, et cetera. But which implies there's more of an order and something even beyond this. Unless Luthen set it, I could also be like, Luthen set this up and pretends that there's someone else behind him and he's just the middleman, when in fact maybe he's running the whole thing. I don't know. But that oath implies that there is more, organization here than we thought.
Yeah. I think that's interesting. We haven't really gotten an insight onto that. But I do think you're right that Luthen is the guy who is, he's not quite a sociopath, but he's almost a sociopath, which is like, I'm just going to tell everybody exactly what they need to hear because I need to get my way. But like, I'm a sociopath who's working towards a good cause, basically. But yeah, I think I went into about halfway through the season, was like, man, Luthen feels like he is a character who might get killed by the end of season one. But it certainly seems like, not to say a spoiler too much, the conversations with Tony Gilroy seem to indicate like, now there's more stuff to investigate with Luthen. He is such a critical player that we're going to see him continue to evolve. to jump to our last plot, which is back on Ferrix.
Marva
is still not doing well. They're trying to convince a doctor to come, and she's not having it. And we see both Cinta and what looks like an Imperial spy are both watching the house. Everybody is still waiting for Cassian, which sort of tees up that he is probably got to come back at some point.
Yeah, I think it's my hunch on this is I think it's through Cinta's eyes that we're watching them enter, which makes me think that Cinta is aware of the Imperial spy, but the Imperial spy is not aware of Cinta. So I think we're getting to a point of it does seem like the last two episodes is going to have Cassian going back. And I'm trying to figure out, does Cinta have a change of heart and pull Cassian out of the way and try to rescue him? But which would be interesting because Cinta is also the most dedicated to the cause and she's been told to kill him. So, yeah, I don't know where this is going to go, but I can see them going back to Ferrix.
Yeah. And especially I think of Ferrix as Ferrix is kind of this initial spark of the rebellion, which may not go great for Ferrix, but I feel like there may be more things to happen at Ferrix. And you could see the Imperials trying to arrest Cassian or something like that spilling over. You know, I don't know. I just feel like that hotel is going to burn down.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I was thinking about Marva's the comment about Marva knowing about the tunnels underneath and wanting to blow it up. I was like, yep, that feels like we put a flag in that. There's a flashpoint looking to happen here. And I think, you know, we still have Bix. I mean, there's so many. I mean, and let's not forget, we do not see Cyril Karn this week, basically, at all.
He's just eating cereal this week, Dan.
Eating cereal.
Just hanging out, doing field party. What's interesting about Karn is, and again, in the series of... there was a series of press pushes by Tony Gilroy this week. He talks about Karn, and he says that he's pushed back on people calling Karn a fascist, which I think I was noted several times that I think of Karn as an ideologue and a zealot. But if I'm interested that, if that's not what's actually going on, we're still not sure which way... I think there's now potential that Karn actually... goes a different way, which I didn't see happening, but I guess Karn's allegiance. Could he break good? I don't know what the plot is to get there, but maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, there is a simpleness to Karn that I could see him ending up in a very different place. I mean, there's a foolishness to him in terms of his very... I mean, I think he engages in a lot of kind of black and white thinking.
Naivety, too.
Yeah, he's a very naive character, and you could see his eyes being opened to something. I don't think he's going to necessarily end up on the side of the rebellion, but he might choose to do something in a certain opportunity that could cost him his life or something, right?
I think that is the question, is he is at some point going to have to make a choice. For some reason, I don't know what it is, what puts him in that moment, but I think there is a moment where he is placed in a position of having to make a choice that is going to have a really big impact. And it is basically either, regardless of whether he's siding with the rebellion or the Empire, he's going to make a choice between the rebellion and the Empire. And I don't know what that's going to be or how it's going to play out, but I think it's going to be critical.
Yeah, so basically we've been carrying him for 10 episodes then as an unknown variable, right? Yeah, that eventually is going to get worked out. Yeah, I have no idea which way he's going to go or what is going
to
happen.
He's going to confess his love to Cassian.
Seems like he's either going to see that the rebellion is, they're just people, man, or see the Empire for what they really are. Because he is starting from this place of, creepy infatuation with, Miro and the ISB and their methods. And, the show did that kind of... terrifyingly, we talked about it last week of we're rooting for Miro and she's the competent one surrounded by kind of inefficient bureaucracy and we want competence to float to the top and then later it's like haha, now she's torturing people. How do you feel about that, viewers?
Too competent.
The comments about him not being a fascist are, confused me a little bit. But we also don't know where his story ends.
I think it's what it poises to me in terms of a theme is an action speak louder than words moment. A moment where, yes, he's espoused these views and he's thought that this is the way to do things, but when the rubber hits the road, he takes an action that perhaps changes what we think of him. I don't know. That's just kind of the sense I get from a storytelling point of view as how I could see that character evolve. But I know, again, as I've said, the show always zigs when I think it's going to zag. So I have no idea how that's going to play out. But I love that we're even talking about what is this dude like? Because if you just took him from face value, you'd be like, this guy is a fascist. This guy is just interested in like the strong arm of the law, etc. But I think that, you know, this show has pointed out that there's multiple layers to people. And people are complex and nuanced. And I think just taking anything as just, especially when it's presented as starkly as his character has been, I think taking anything just by their face value is a bad idea in this show. So I'm intrigued. I'm intrigued to see where that goes.
And again, I think I don't know what motivates him. But we see him now twice playing essentially dress up, like wanting individuality, wanting to wear the uniform of a soldier. I don't know where he's going to go.
It's worrisome because it feels like he's the bully, right? He's the guy who wants to be a cop or a soldier that you don't want to be a cop or a soldier, right? Yeah. He wants power and authority that he does not have. But he also has this ego about things where he thinks he's better than everybody that he works with. And, you know, he's the one legitimate guy in the security company and whatnot. Which, you know, as we've seen, gets him into trouble. I think there's still some decent ways to go on the Cyril Karn story. Now available as a Lego minifig.
Yes. But he's also Law and Order, right? So I wonder, I do wonder how the character, if he knew what was going on in that prison, and he knew that people's sentences were being doubled truly unnecessarily, I don't know that that would shake him, because you think it's the importance of security over all things.
Flip side of Kino, almost.
Yeah, but then if he found out that was all a lie, and that people were just being, that they were being used for labor and essentially just being put back into other prisons, I do wonder how he would respond to that, if that would actually chip away at his love for the Empire.
Just as corrupt as everybody else.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That maybe could be the angle, if he does in fact flip to the good or flip to something. I agree that I don't think he's going to act with any sort of ideologue, but really just inadvertently becoming an unavailable. Again, we've got two episodes. It's amazing. We only have two episodes left, right? And the show, like, there's all these places the show could go, but the show doesn't move that fast, right? So how do you tie this up all in two 40-minute episodes that are sort of, you never know what scene's going to come next, but we're not going to take big time jumps. We're not going to, like, jump, because we're going to take our time developing characters. I just don't know. I love it. I love it so much. I love the show so very much.
Well, that nicely tees up our one listener question this week, which comes from listener Jay, who says, hope you've seen this week's episode of Andor. It's incredible. Lots of comments on Twitter about Serkis's Kino being a true hero of the rebellion, enabling everything that comes afterwards in Rogue One and A New Hope, etc. Anyway, my question for the team is, Luthen says he woke up 14 years ago, I'm going to say 15 is what I recall, and began planning the rebellion. We know Andor starts in 5 BBY, and we've seen the events over the few months that followed. So Luthen became radicalized in 19 BBY. Was it just the Emperor taking full control that started him on this path, or do we think they'll refer to any other specific event from Revenge of the Sith or the Clone War shows as the incident that inspires Luthen? Anybody got any thoughts on that? We sort of touched on it already, but to me, Luthen reads as a guy who is just like, yeah, it was the Emperor. It's basically the flip from the Republic into the Empire. Like, that was it. That was the moment he decided, like, I need to get
on board. I wonder
with this.
Where was he in his life that he, you know, was that? I mean, I wonder, could he have been an officer in the, because we do have non-clones in kind of leadership roles in the clone army, right? I don't know, maybe he's not old enough to have been that, but you figure he's got to have been somebody of some means and privilege to start flipping the levers that he's flipped. You know, presumably not a senator or someone like that, but he's got it, because he's got power that he's all directing in these different, you know, vectors. So, I just wonder, where was he? And was there some, you know, did he see something specific? Did someone he know get killed or, you know?
Inciting incident, yeah.
I don't think we're ever going to know. I don't think it's just going to go there. But if I had to come up with some sort of, like, mind canon, I'm going to go with the fact that they have holocrons in the background. Maybe he's not a Jedi, but I think he probably was an import-export, because, like, you can't just, like, spring that business overnight. Like, if he's on Coruscant, it's more difficult to, I think, invent a false life there versus all the other false lives he's done across. And to make the connection to Mon Mothma, and I've got to assume he knows Bail Organa, I like to think that he potentially just was maybe a bit of a player and did know and knew the Jedi and knew Order 66 and knew how corrupt that was. Mm. He had to have some sort of inside track there to realize what had happened, and knew the Jedi were not as corrupt as the Empire wants you to believe. That's could my be. Mind canon, at least.
Yeah, I'm not sure we'll ever know, but it's an interesting question.
Yeah.
All right, two episodes left to go, downhill run, and lots to wrap up in those times. Of course, we already know there's a second season coming, and that season will cover the next 4 years, basically, from the end of this season to Rogue One, but still a lot of runway there. I will try to put all those links to Tony Gilroy interviews in the show notes, because they are interesting and worth reading if you're interested in that sort of thing. I would encourage you, of course, if you got questions for us, comments, feel free to send them over email, acp@theincomparable.com. For the moment, we're still on Twitter @acp_cast.
What's our Mastodon account?
So far uncreated.
Yeah.
But I would like to thank my co-hosts as always. Kat Benish, thank you for being here.
It's been a delight.
Tony Sindelar, always a pleasure.
Everything.
One way out.
One way out.
Technical programming note, we received a lot of feedback last episode about bad crosstalk. We have done some things this episode, both technical and human level, to attempt to make that better. We hope it was not as bad as last episode. Sorry about that.
Yeah, sorry.
Well, we appreciate all your thoughts and comments, and thank you for sharing your feedback with us. We endeavor to provide the best Star Wars podcast experience that you can find anywhere for the amount that you pay for it. thank you, everybody out there, for listening. We'll see you next week. But until then, may the Force be with you.